Where did she serve? Iraq and Afghanistan, 5 times. A tough character, like you wouldn't believe. If it's the same woman, it might be. Would such a woman come home and use smelly soap and wear pink socks? I'm sure she would do exactly that. Stuff like that is the whole point of coming home. Connolly turned around and looked back at the house, at the broken window. Reacher said, I know. You know what? We can't figure out who would have done that either. It's good, clean, professional work. A neat break-in and nothing disturbed inside. Feels like training and experience were involved. Feels like government work. Except that's ridiculous. Connolly said, mostly because what would the government want with Porterfield? Whatever he was small-time, and a government agency would have called me first, as a courtesy at least, and for practical assistance, too, which I could have given them in this case. I had the keys. Then regular petty criminals are getting neater these days. That hasn't been my experience. Then who was it? Fancy criminals, maybe. The kind who can afford the best? What would they want with small-time Porterfield? Connolly didn't answer. Bramall said, We apologize for trespassing. We intended no disrespect to the laws of the county. Connolly said, I can't help you with the woman. There's no evidence of a crime. I can't take soap and towels to a county board budget hearing. I'm sorry. I have no manpower.
Who could help us? Bramall said.
Neighbors? They might. I'm their sheriff, but I don't know any of them. In fact, this is only the second time I've ever been out here. It's a quiet corner. The squeaky wheels get all my attention.
We should get going, Bramall said.
Sheriff, thank you for your time. At that moment, 300 miles away in Rapid City, South Dakota, Gloria Nakamura was sitting in her blue car on the cross street. Artfully positioned, this time watching Scorpio's back door, not his front. She had been there close to 2 hours, and she had seen nothing of interest. Until a Harley with a Montana plate pulled into the alley. The sound beat back off the walls, then it shut down. The rider got off, and the back door opened, and the rider went in. Nakamura made a note. 4 minutes on her watch later, the rider came out again. He got on his bike and started the noise again and rode away. Nakamura made a note. Then she drove back to the station. Bramall and Reacher drove the ranch track back to the dirt road and turned west, which was where they thought they would find the bulk of the local neighborhood population, such as it was. Bramall watched the left-hand shoulder and Reacher watched the right. They agreed they would take the first track they saw, whichever side of the road it was on, because by definition whatever dwelling lay at the end of it was Cy Porterfield's nearest next-door neighbor. The first track came 11 miles later, on the left. They nearly missed it. It was a plain and inconspicuous entry, after which it twisted and rose through the trees, steep and tight in places, but better maintained than Porterfield's. The Land Cruiser rolled on, implacably more than 3 miles, and then all of a sudden the trees opened up and gave out on a flat acre with a long view east. There was a one-story house up on a stone foundation. It was made of brown boards, in places twisted and silvery. It had a front porch with ancient millwork holding up the rail. On the porch was an old church pew, pressed into service as a place to sit and take the air in the morning sun. Bramall parked a respectful distance from the house. He checked his phone.
Two bars, he said. Coverage is actually pretty good here. She could have called from anywhere.
They made to get out of the car, but before they could, the house door opened and a woman stepped out. She must have heard their tires. She looked lean and strong and tanned by wind and sun. She was wearing a faded red dress over bare legs and cowboy boots. She was maybe 40, but it was hard to tell. Reacher would not have ventured an opinion. If forced, he would have said 30 just to be safe, and wouldn't have been surprised if the truth was 50. She stood there, hands on hips, just watching. Not hostile. Not yet. Bramall said,
"She thinks we're Mormons."
Reacher got out. He raised his hand, a universal gesture, unarmed, friendly. She moved her head, part responsive, part inquiring. Bramall got out. He and Reacher walked together and stopped a polite distance short of the porch. Reacher said, "Ma'am, we're looking for a missing woman who we think once stayed a spell with your neighbor Cy Porterfield. We wonder if you could tell us about that."
"You should come in," the woman said. "I have lemonade in the jug."
Chapter 20 Reacher and Bramall followed the woman inside. The walls were made of the same boards as the outside, but stained and polished, not weather-beaten. The kitchen was a low, dark room. The woman poured lemonade into glasses. They sat down at her table.
"Are you private detectives?"
she asked.
"I am,"
Bramall said. She looked at Reacher. He said, "Military investigator." Which was true, in a historic sense. She said,
"Was it last year Cy died, or the year before?"
"Last year," Reacher said, "the start of spring."
"I didn't know him very well. Never really met him except once or twice. Seemed to be a solitary type of guy, always coming and going."
"What did he do for a living?"
"None of us knew."
"Us? Did you talk about him with other people?"
"That's what neighbors do. You don't like it, mister? Go live on the moon."
"What was the consensus opinion?"
"We all thought he was a solitary guy, always coming and going."
"No one saw any sign of a woman living there?"
"Never," she said,
which sounded definitive. Reacher said, "You ever heard the name Serena?"
"In my life?"
"Around here?"
"Nope,"
she said. "Or Rose?"
"Nope."
"Or Sanderson?"
"Nope."
Reacher said, "We found stuff in Porterfield's house."
"What kind?"
"Random items of women's apparel and toiletries. Not much, like very faint clues." The woman said nothing. Then she said,
"How faint?"
"We know the bathroom was used by two people," Reacher said. The woman said,
"Huh."
"What does that mean?"
"It means, I guess, one time I wondered something. In the end, I figured I made a mistake."
"Wondered what?"
"I was on the dirt road heading out to the turn at Mule Crossing. He was driving the other way, from the turn heading home. It's rare to see another car. It kind of perks you up. It makes you get in your own lane and so forth. You don't want to get in a collision. So we passed each other by. We kind of waved, I guess. No big deal. Except I was sure he had someone in the passenger seat beside him. I thought it was a girl, just a glimpse. She was hunched down low, turned away from him, kind of pressing herself into the side of the seat. I couldn't see her face."
"How old?"
"Not young. Not a kid. Quite small, and agile, I guess. She was all twisted around, hiding her face from him." weird, and silvery, somehow. That's what I remember, a silvery color.
Also weird.
I thought so, too. It stayed on my mind, so the next day I went over there. I took him a pie, said I had one extra. But really, the check? Back then there were all kinds of stories, human trafficking and custody disputes. Maybe he was into that kind of stuff. Or maybe she really was a genuine girlfriend. Who knew? Maybe they had been having a fight in the car. I figured they might be over it by then, and he would introduce me.
What happened?
He acted weird. He was pleased about the pie, very polite, but he wouldn't let me in the house. We talked on the porch. He pulled the door almost shut behind him and stood where I couldn't see through the gap. He didn't say much. I tried to introduce the subject. I said, I was sorry the pie was too big, for one. It was a natural opening. It gave him a chance to tell me he was planning to share it with his girlfriend. But he didn't. He said he would wrap the second slice in aluminum foil and eat it in a couple days.
What kind of pie was it?
Strawberry,
the woman said.
They had some nice ones at the market, where I was going when I passed him on the road.
What happened next?
Nothing. That was it. It was kind of awkward just standing there, so I said, okay, I guess I'll get going. And he said thanks again for the pie, and then he practically rushed me off his property.
What was your conclusion?
It was in the way he was standing. He was screening me off from the house. He was hiding something in there, or someone. Then I got to wondering about when I saw him in the car. Maybe she was hiding her face from me, not him. Maybe he told her to, like she was his secret.
But you never found out for sure.
I never saw him again. He was dead a month later. No one ever said anything about a widow or a partner or a girlfriend or a sex slave or a hostage. So in the end, I figured I must have been wrong. Then, I guess I forgot all about it. Time passes.
How long had he lived there?
5 years, maybe.
Did any of the neighbors ever take a wild-ass guess about what he did for money?
That would enter the realm of gossip.
I guess it would, technically.
We figured he already had plenty. We figured he was a rich guy from out of state come to find himself. We get those from time to time. Maybe they're writing a novel.
At that moment, 300 miles away in Rapid City, South Dakota, the clerk behind the deli counter in the convenience store was finishing up making change for a BLT and a diet soda, and then picking up the phone and dialing the police department. He said,
"Excuse me, I think you have a woman detective working for you? An Oriental person? A Japanese-American or Asian or whatever it's supposed to be now? I need to speak with her."
The call was transferred, and a voice said,
"Property, Nakamura. This is the guy from the convenience store on the corner by Arthur Scorpio's laundromat. I got something I figure I need to tell you before you find out for yourself and get mad at me." "What kind of something?" "Arthur Scorpio just came in." "And?" "He bought another phone." "How long ago?"
5 minutes.
"Which phone?"
"First one off the left peg."
Also at that moment, Arthur Scorpio was dialing Billy in Wyoming again. Again there was no answer, just voicemail. Scorpio said,
"Billy, this is Arthur. I need to hear from you. You're making me worried now. What's with not answering your phone all the time? And you got that guy coming? Plus maybe another guy? We just got a message from Montana. They sent a rider down especially. They have a Fed up there.
asking questions. He just left Billings. We don't know where he's headed next. Eyes open, okay? And call me back. Don't make me worried, Billy. He clicked off and dropped the phone in the trash basket. Rommel's phone dinged. Reacher figured it was a text message. He was getting where he could tell the difference. The woman in the faded red dress got up and started to gather the empty lemonade glasses. Rommel read his message. Twice, he said.
"Ma'am, the lemonade was delicious, but I'm afraid we really have to get going now."
Then he just stood up and hustled out the door. Reacher shrugged at the woman, palms up as if in puzzlement. Another universal gesture. "Yeah, I know, but I better go with my crazy friend." He followed Bramble outside and across the dirt to the car. He said, "What's up?" Bramble said,
"Mrs. McKenzie is dissatisfied with progress so far and informs me she's going to Wyoming to search certain places near the old family homestead herself. Apparently, she's reconsidering her opinion her sister would never go back there."
"Doesn't she know you're only 60 miles away?"
"No," Bramall said. "I never tell clients where I am."
"Why not?"
"I like to build up the mystery."
"You can take the boy out of the FBI."
"We need to get there first."
"When is she leaving Chicago?"
"She'll charter a plane. She has a card. We should go there now. We should have gone there first, but I was told Sanderson would never return. Now we're saying maybe she did?"
"Terrific.
Maybe she's been there all along. It's a 2-hour drive. Nothing for Porterfield to complain about."
Sheriff Connolly had said a government agency would call him first before entering on his territory, at least as a courtesy, which is exactly what happened. He got back from his impromptu trip out to the old Porterfield place, and 2 minutes later his phone rang with a field agent from the federal DEA. The guy said he was heading south from Montana and sooner or later was going to be passing through the county, nothing much in mind, maybe stopping in one or two places, but overall nothing for anyone to get concerned about. He said he didn't require assistance or any other courtesies, but thank you very much for asking. Then he hung up. There was a big difference between crows flying and cars driving. To get across the snowy range, first they had to go back to the dirt road, and then back to Mule Crossing itself, and past the old post office and the bottle rocket store, and all the way back to Laramie, all in order to pick up a different westward route, which started with a left turn about 4 blocks north of the bar with the bullet hole in the mirror. Then the trip started all over again at zero. Still 70 miles to go. Reacher told Bramall to look on the bright side. More hours on the invoice. Bramall told a joke about a lawyer who died and got to the pearly gates.
"Not fair," he said. "I'm only 45.
St. Pete said, "No, we got a new system. Now we do it by billable hours. According to our records, you're 153. They passed a sign that said the road would close pretty soon for the winter, and then it started to rise into the mountains up over 10,000 feet into thin and glittering air. The Toyota slowed a little, but it kept on going, winding through rocky gaps and around sparse copses of wind-stunted trees, across what already felt like the roof of the world. Then the road held level through a wide half-mile curve and started to fall again, through the same type of gaps and around the same type of trees, and the Toyota started rolling faster and faster under its own weight with no gas at all. 30 miles later, the navigation screen showed a thin tracery of ranch roads, 2 on the north side and 2 on the south. Beyond them,
was blank. Is that it? Reacher asked.
I think so, Bramble said.
Apparently, one of the ranches is bigger than the other three. That's the old homestead. The others came later. Did the sisters inherit? No, the place was sold when they were in college. The parents moved out, new owners moved in, and so on. The same with the other three places, I'm sure. You think she's squatting in one of them? I doubt a person who has to pawn her ring is paying rent. Why would they be empty? Rural real estate often is. Places shrivel and die, especially when the neighborhood royalty moves out. Is that your description, or Mrs. McKenzie's?
A little of both.
Their father was a judge, which back then, in a place like this, made him the most important man in the county. Everything came through the courts eventually. Mrs. McKenzie seems aware of that. Why did the parents move out? Mrs. McKenzie had a hard time explaining. I'm sure we could speculate. I'm sure as kids they both had ponies on a judge's salary. I'm sure all Wyoming kids have ponies. There are more ponies than kids. It was a metaphor for little arrangements that work great until they don't. Then sometimes you need to get out of town and start over. Is that how Mrs. McKenzie remembers it? She was in college at the time. In the end, she credits George W. Bush. She claims it was an entrepreneurial thing. The old man was moving from the public sector to the private. To do what, exactly? No one knew, exactly, except they noticed it stopped the day after the banks crashed. Where is the old boy now?
Dead soon after.
Mom?
Also dead, but much more recently still raw.
Hence the sudden worry about her semi-estranged twin.
Exactly, Bramble said. Now her semi-estranged twin is all she's got.
They had no way of knowing which of the tracks led to the largest ranch, because they all ran far out of sight into the invisible distance. So they tried to judge by width or construction or other hint of architectural grandeur. In the end, they agreed one track was wider than the others. Possibly the surface was better. There were piles of rocks that might once have been ceremonial gateposts, like the archaeological remains of a once mighty palace. The Toyota turned in and started climbing. Chapter 21. The old homestead was both old and a homestead. It was a classic piece of Western real estate, with wide, tawny pastures and dark green conifer trees and outcrops of rock and bubbling blue water in streams through the bottoms. Way in the distance were the Rocky Mountains, just hints in the mist. The main house was a spreading log construction with all kinds of extra wings built out. There were log barns and log garages. A lot of logs, Reacher thought, and all of them old school, huge and heavy, hard as a rock, smoothed by axes and joined by pegs, like an old-time travel poster on an airport wall. Except for a new model rental sedan parked at an angle, and a woman standing next to it. The sedan was a handsome item with a Chevrolet grille, basic red, with barcodes in all the back windows. The woman was small and slender, maybe 5'2" and 100 pounds. She was wearing boots and boot-cut blue jeans and a gauzy white shirt under an open leather jacket. She had a purse on her shoulder. She had long, thick hair, heaped and wild and tangled, most of it pale red,
some of it bleached by the sun. Her face was like a picture in a book. Pale, flawless skin, perfect bones, delicate features, green eyes, frank and open, a red mouth, confident, in control, almost smiling, radiant, composed. She had to be 30-something, but she looked brand new, like a movie star.
Shit, Grandma said. That's Mrs. McKenzie.
The twin sister, an exact replica. Army minimum for women was 4'10 and 91 pounds. Sanderson would have gotten in comfortably. But everything else would have been twice as hard from that point onward, especially with the face. It was drop-dead spectacular. Bramall got out of the car. He took a couple of steps and stopped. So did she. Then Reacher got out. He heard Bramall say,
"Mrs. McKenzie, I didn't expect to see you so soon."
She said, "One of those things. The text didn't send till we landed. You thought I was leaving Chicago. Actually, I was leaving the Hertz office in Laramie."
"I was close by."
"Of course you were, for which I apologize most sincerely. Fact and logic brought you to Wyoming, but I wouldn't let you get all the way here. I told you it was impossible she would come back."
"What changed?"
"You should introduce me to your friend." Richard stepped up and said his name and shook her hand. It felt like a dove's wing in a gorilla's paw.
"What changed?"
Bramall said again.
"Now I'm afraid nothing has changed," Mackenzie said. "This place is empty. I think I made a mistake. I wasted a day. I apologize."
"Why would she come back here?"
"Suddenly I thought familiarity might be important to her. I try to think like her. We had some good times here. 18 years of stability. Since then she's had none. I thought it might be something she's craving."
Reacher looked up at the house. He asked, "How long has it been empty?" She said,
"I think it's just someone's summer house now."
"It's still summer."
"They must have skipped this year."
"Do you remember who bought it?"
Mackenzie shook her head.
"I'm not sure we ever knew. I was away in school and Rose was at West Point."
"You call her Rose?"
"We insisted. Jane and Rose."
"How did you feel when you found out your folks had sold the place?"
"May I know the root of your interest in my family's affairs?"
So Reacher ran through the story one more time, from the bus out of Milwaukee all the way to the there and then across the snowy range. But some kind of instinct made him smooth it out as he went. He stayed strictly on the poignant pawned ring track and didn't mention either Scorpio or Billy or speculate about anyone's specific occupation. He ended with the meager trove of evidence from Cy Porterfield's hall closet and his living room sofa and his master bathroom and his laundry room. Mackenzie was quiet a beat. Then she said,
"What size were the boots?"
6, Reacher said.
"Okay."
He looked at her hair, heaped, wild, tangled. Untamed was the word. Must take forever to wash. "An exact replica," he said. "Show me your comb." She paused again, then she said,
"Yes, I see."
She dug in her bag and came out with a pink plastic comb. All the teeth were widely spaced, not half and half, like a regular comb. Reacher said,
"Have you always used that brand?"
"It's the only kind that works."
"It's the same."
The boots fit, too.
He took the ring from his pocket and balanced it on his palm. She picked it up, carefully, between delicate fingers. West Point, 2005. The gold filigree, the black stone, the tiny size. She read the engraving. She selected a finger and pulled off a designer bauble as thick and gold as a false tooth. In its place, she slipped her sister's trophy. Fourth finger, right hand. It sat there like it should. The perfect fit. The perfect size. Prominent, like it should be, and proud, like it should be, but not as big as a carnival prize. Reacher pictured the same hand, but maybe worn down a bit leaner, with a darker tan, and a couple of nicks and cuts healed white. He pictured the same face, the same way. Mackenzie said,
"You mentioned that you bought the ring?"
"Correct," Reacher said.
"May I buy it back from you?"
"It's not for sale. It's a gift for your sister."
"I could give it to her."
"So could the lady at West Point, eventually."
"You feel a need to hand it over personally?"
"I need to know she's okay."
"You never met her."
"Makes no difference. Should it?" "I don't know. You tell me." Mackenzie took the ring off. She handed it back. Some kind of look on her perfect face. Reacher said,
"I know."
"You know what?"
"I know what you're thinking. You're here because it's family, and Mr. Bramall is here because he's getting paid. Why am I here? I'm giving you the impression I'm some kind of a weird obsessive, maybe a couple soldiers short of a squad. I don't mean to, but I get it. I'm making you feel uncomfortable."
"Not at all."
"You're very polite."
"I assume it's an honor thing. Rose was in a world I didn't understand."
"What we need now is solid information. Are you confident this place is empty?"
"There are dust sheets everywhere, and the water is off."
"So where would Rose go, if not here?"
"This is ridiculous."
"What is?" Reacher said.
"I should be on a psychiatrist's couch to answer these questions."
"Why?"
"We participated in a fantasy, okay? We were required to, as if we were lords of the manor and owned the whole valley, as if when the neighbors built, we were practically giving them almshouses out of sheer benevolence. Obviously, later on, we discovered Father had to sell some acres, but it was like we still owned them, like slave quarters. We lorded it over the poor people. We were in and out any time we wanted."
"Which of the three would you go to now?"
"Any of them."
"You want a ride? In the front, if you like. You're paying the bills, after all." Reacher got in the back and got comfortable. Mackenzie took his place in the passenger seat. Bramall drove, but not back to the road. Mackenzie showed him different tracks, the ways they went as kids. Easy enough for a slip of a girl to skip along. Harder for the car. But it made it, bending saplings, all four tires grabbing like a ponderous cat. The nearest neighbor slid into view. Not a trophy cabin. Built before the word existed. The product of a more innocent age, when a vacation house could be a plain and simple thing. The view was a picture postcard. Bramall and Mackenzie went to the door. They knocked. It opened. A guy stood there. Same kind of age as the guy in the Mule Crossing post office. Same kind of tired-out stoop. Bramall said something to him, then Mackenzie, and the old guy nodded and made to let them in. Bremmel turned and waved to Reacher, and Reacher got out of the car and walked over to join them. They went inside, and the old guy said yes, all those years ago he had bought the land and built the house for family vacations. Now he came alone, which was borne out by the evidence. Reacher looked around and saw one of everything, and felt the quiet, patient air of a lonely place. The guy said he remembered the twins coming by. Way back, there were wild-haired little girls in country dresses. They visited all the time until they were 10 or 12, and not so much until they were 15 or so, and then hardly at all after that. Mackenzie said,
"Have you seen Rose recently?"
The old guy said, "Where would I see her?"
"Around here, maybe?"
I guess it's its own question to ask what she looks like now.
Mackenzie smiled.
"Maybe a bit more tan than me. Maybe a bit more toned. She would claim she's been working harder. She might have cut her hair or dyed it. She might have gotten tattoos."
She looked the question at Bramall.
"Anything else we should consider?"
Bramall looked the question at Reacher.
"Is this where we tell her she was wounded?"
"No," Reacher said. "I'm sure the gentleman knows what she looks like."
"I haven't seen her," the old guy said.
They used the old guy's driveway and crossed the road and took the driveway opposite. It came out on another idyllic scene, but smaller, a quarter-sized version of the old homestead, with a newer house and no active stream. The house was closed up and empty. Locked doors, shaded windows, no broken glass. No burglars, no squatters, no feral Rose Sanderson going to earth in a place she remembered. They moved off again on another rough trail Mackenzie seemed half to know and half to imagine. The Toyota squeezed between trees and rode up and down dips and hollows and bucked and nodded. Bramall stayed calm behind the wheel. He drove most of the way one-handed. The last house came into view. It was the same kind of thing as before, an unpretentious, A-framed cabin with a lot of glass on a spectacular view. Bramall looped around to the driveway as if he had been on it all along, and he parked a respectful distance from the house. The front door opened. A woman stood in the shadow. She must have heard their tires. She took a hopeful step forward, into the sun. She looked like Porterfield's neighbor, but wound up way tighter, upset about something. She was staring all around and then staring at the car. Bramall got out. She watched him. Mackenzie got out. She watched her. Reacher got out. She watched him. No one else got out. She staggered back, like she had been hit in the head. She leaned on the frame of the door. She said,
"Have you guys seen Billy?"
Bramall didn't answer. The woman said,
"I thought maybe you were him. Maybe he got a new car. He's supposed to be coming."
"For what?" Reacher said.
"Have you seen him?"
Mackenzie said,
"Who is Billy?"
Reacher said, "We'll get to that." To the woman in the doorway, he said, "I got a question for you first, and then I'll tell you about Billy."
"What's the question?"
"Tell me about the other woman, who looks just like my friend here, like her twin sister."
"What other woman?"
"I just told you, pay attention, like my friend here, in this neighborhood."
"Never seen her."
"She might be Billy's friend, too."
"Don't know her."
"You sure?"
"A woman who looks like her? Never seen one."
"You ever heard the name Rose?"
"Never, ever. Now tell me about Billy."
"I haven't met him yet," Reacher said. "But I hear his privileges were suspended. his cupboard is bare, until he takes care of a local problem, which he hasn't yet. I know that, because I'm the local problem, and here I still am. So if he happens to drop by, tell him I'm looking for him, the Incredible Hulk. Tell him I plan to stop by and pay him a visit. Give him a good description. That might be worth $20 to him. He could get a freebie.
Billy never gives freebies, the woman said.
Who is Billy? Mackenzie asked again. They told her in the car, not the whole story. Still, they kept him separate, as if he was an accidental discovery off to one side. They told her about the shoebox of cash, but not the shoebox of jewelry. But Mackenzie was a smart woman. She said,
"Then why were you in his home in the first place?"
Which, under her critical gaze, led to the whole soup-to-nuts narrative, involving Scorpio and Porterfield and Billy and Bramall's old phone records and Nakamura's overheard voicemails. Mackenzie said,
"In other words, for at least 2 years, Rose has been involved with drug dealers and drug users, meth and heroin, with all that entails. Such a shacking up with one who got eaten by a bear."
They didn't answer. Mackenzie asked, quietly,
"Is she an addict?"
They told her about the shoebox of jewelry. She started to cry. Chapter 22 They drove back to the old homestead, where Mackenzie's rental was parked at an angle like a garish red blot on the old-timey landscape. She said,
"Now I'm worried about the time scale. Her comb was lost at least a year and a half ago. We know that. Possibly months before. This is likely a 2-year thing or more, but her ring left Wyoming just 6 weeks ago. Doesn't that feel like a final threshold? Some kind of end stage?"
Reacher said, "Did you call the army during your search?"
"They told me nothing. They had privacy concerns. Any other time I would have been cheering them on."
"I called a place I know. I pulled some strings. They didn't have much. They had a list of her West Point scores. She did very well."
"I remember.
They had a list of her deployments, Iraq and Afghanistan, 5 tours and out."
"Okay."
"They had a list of her medals."
"I didn't know she won any."
"She won a Bronze Star."
"For what?"
"The regulation says the Bronze Star Medal is awarded to individuals who distinguished themselves in a combat theater by heroism, outstanding achievement, or meritorious service."
"I didn't know,"
Mackenzie said again. "She also won a Purple Heart." Mackenzie was quiet a long moment. First she said, "I didn't know," then she said,
"What for?"
Last she said,
"Oh no."
Reacher didn't recite the regulation, not happy listening. "Awarded to any member of the armed forces who has been wounded, killed, or who has died or may die of wounds." Mackenzie said,
"How bad?"
"Can't tell," Reacher said. "Right now it's just the name of a medal. Lots of people have them. As a matter of fact, I have one. Truth is, none of them come cheap. Most of them leave a mark. But you heal up and you walk away. Almost always. Certainly a big percentage. Doesn't have to be bad news." Mackenzie said,
"Iraq and Afghanistan were all bad news."
She looked ahead at her sleek red car. She said,
"I'm not going home. I'm staying here. She's close. You said so yourself. She's in trouble. Maybe she lost an arm. Maybe she's a disabled veteran with nowhere to live and nothing to eat."
She told him to follow her back to the Hertz office and then take her to see Billy's place. Nakamura carried her laptop down the corridor to her lieutenant's corner suite. She played the captured voicemail.
We just got a message from Montana. They sent a rider down, especially. They have a fed up there asking questions. He just left Billings.
She said, I saw the rider from Montana. He was there 4 minutes. Her lieutenant said, does this get us anywhere? My friend in the lab is doing great work with predicting the phone numbers.
What does he want? A medal of honor?
A pat on the back would be good. You know, stick your head in, say hi.
What do you want?
It would be good to know what kind of fed they had up there in Billings. And it would be good to know who sent the warning. Was it a subsidiary, an affiliate, a franchise, or just a friendly bunch of guys all loosely in the same boat?
What do you want me to do about it?
Call the Billings PD and ask them who was in town last night. They'll know because they'll have gotten a courtesy call ahead of time.
And this guy is going to Wyoming next. Remind me again, why should I care?
Because Scorpio got one of his tentacles trodden on. If we knew exactly who he's scared of, maybe we could work out exactly what he's doing.
The lieutenant called through a closed hutch to his secretary and told her to get a number for whatever captain or commissioner or other fancy rank was top boy in the Billings PD over in Montana, and then to dial it and put it on line one. They got to Billy's place in the late afternoon. The sun was over the distant mountains. The pronghorns were throwing shadows taller than they were. The colors were different. The place was still empty. They went in the kitchen door and up to the slept-in bedroom, to the closet. Reacher put the shoeboxes on the bed. Mackenzie whirred her finger down the wadded cash and then poked through the jewelry, pushing her nail through the inch of clinking metal, gathering necklace chains as fine as hair, tumbling high school rings aside and brassy, wise guy pinky finger signet rings with black onyx faces and tiny, off-center chips of diamond. She said,
"Was the pawn shop window like this?"
"Exactly like that," Reacher said.
"Poor Rose.
You know this area?"
"I know Laramie, or I used to. Down here was all railroad land. Before the track was laid, they used mules, hence the name, probably."
"No old friends or relatives?"
7 months of the year the road is closed. This was the other side of the world to us."
"Nowhere she would remember?"
"From later on, probably bars and restaurants downtown. Some stores, possibly. Sometimes we went out to the university, for music or whatever. But I don't think she would want to live out there now. We're 35 years old."
"So where?"
"Forget what I said. Ignore familiarity. I was wrong. I was desperate. Every idea looked like a good idea. Maybe she chose unfamiliarity instead, somewhere she didn't know at all."
"She knows Wyoming."
"Exactly. To have both is just right. Familiarity and unfamiliarity."
Richard checked the view from the bedroom window. There was dust on the dirt road, a long cloud, vivid red in the softening light, spiraling and drifting, a tiny dot at its head, winking in the low sun. 6 minutes, maybe.
"Coming here?"
Bramall said.
"Maybe," Reacher said. "Maybe not. But I hope so. I hope it's Billy. He knows where Rose lives, from plowing her driveway, if nothing else."
"He might have his deer rifle."
"Has he listened to his voicemail yet?"
"We didn't check."
"I guess he could have snuck home at some point to fast in and out. We've been gone for hours."
"Okay," Reacher said.
"How do you want to do this?"
"Inside, obviously. Downstairs would be best. There's a poker on the fireplace. I'll head in that direction. You take the other side. Find what you can. Look for steak knives, often in a sideboard drawer. Mackenzie said,
What should I do?
You go check if the phone is still there, on the desk in the back parlor. If it is, it should say one new message. That's how Mr. Bramall left it. If it's there, but it's showing a regular screen, that means Billy came back and listened to it, but left the phone home again for whatever reason. So check it out and tell us which. Shout it out good and loud, then we'll know what we're dealing with here. We'll know how hard to hit the guy.
If it's Billy,
Bramall said.
Hope for the best, Reacher said.
They went down the stairs, Reacher first heading left, then Bramall heading right, and last, Mackenzie, looping back toward the parlor. Reacher took a look out the front window. The dust was closer. It was lit up from within by the setting sun. 4 minutes, maybe. He moved on to the fireplace and picked up the poker, the yard of iron with the hook at the end, like a hitchhiker's thumb. Mackenzie called out,
The phone is still here, and now it says two new messages.
Reacher paused a beat, then he called back.
Listen to the second one.
He heard a static whisper from the distant earpiece as the first message was skipped, and then more as the second was played. He figured there might be some kind of urgency behind the faint, breathy cadence. Mackenzie called out,
It's Arthur Scorpio, leaving another voicemail for Billy. They got a warning about a federal agent leaving Montana for parts unknown, and Scorpio wants Billy to call him back. He sounds mad. He said, Don't make me worried, Billy. Not in a nice way.
Bramall said,
Got to be either ATF or DEA in Montana. They both have Western task forces.
Reacher said,
I don't care.
They waited. From the shadows deep in the room, Reacher saw a truck nose through the trees and come out at the top of the driveway. Not a pickup truck. It was a Chevy Suburban SUV, the large size. Black in color, but caked red from the road. A basic specification. Cheap wheels, not much chrome. An aftermarket antenna mounted in the center of the roof. It crunched over the dirt and came to a stop not far from Bramall's Toyota. A guy got out. He was broad, but not tall, maybe 50-something, with a lot of hard miles on his clock. He was dressed in gray flannel pants and a tweed sport coat. He moved with a certain amount of grace, maybe once an athlete, given his shape, probably field, not track. Maybe he had put the shot or thrown the discus. Now he worked for the government. The pants and the coat and the truck made that clear.
Relax, guys, Reacher called. Step down to DEFCON 2.
Mackenzie called back.
What does that mean?
We'll try talking to this guy before we do anything else.
Is it Billy?
I'm pretty sure not, Reacher said. Out on the dirt, the guy tweaked the tails of his coat and squared up his shoulders and headed for the porch. On the way, he took out an ID wallet and held it ready. Reacher saw straps under his coat for a shoulder holster. They heard footsteps on the porch boards and then a knock at the door. Chapter 23 Bramall opened up. Reacher and Mackenzie stood behind him. The guy from the government car held up a federal ID, a worn gold badge with a shield and an eagle, and a plastic card like a driver's license, except it said, United States Department of Justice, Drug Enforcement Administration. The photograph was the right guy, a little younger, with his hair brushed better and his tie knotted tighter. The writing said his name was Kirk Noble, and his rank was special agent. Reacher couldn't help it. He said,
Sounds like a comic book. Kirk Noble, boy detective.
No response.
I guess you never heard that before.
Noble said, Who are you?
They all introduced themselves, names only.
Noble said, What are you doing here?
Reacher said, We're waiting for a guy named Billy. He lives here. We want to ask him a question.
What question?
We're looking for a missing woman. We think he knows where she is.
What woman?
Reacher had no real sense that Noble could help, but he knew for sure he could hinder if he wanted to. He worked for the government. He had a shield with an eagle. He had a thick book of rules. So Reacher told the story fair and square, maybe somewhat aware of his federal audience, maybe nudging a little ways toward a certain kind of circular argument in which the participants' professional backgrounds not only justified but actually required their involvement, while simultaneously absolving them of any kind of blame because of their status, as in a retired military major with a silver star and a purple heart, joined a near 40-year veteran of the FBI, now a properly licensed private investigator in a populous state, to search for another retired military major, this one with a bronze star and a purple heart all her own. Feds couldn't argue with stuff like that, not without saying, Yeah, all our lives are bullshit. And even if they did, there was the twin sister, right there, a connection so spectrally close it legitimized everything in a blinding flash, like bleach thrown on a crime scene, especially with the face and the hair. Noble was a guy. Deep down, he wasn't thinking legal technicalities. He was thinking, there are two like that?
Reacher kept it as subtle as he could. Eventually, he finished up.
Noble said, You won't get an answer to your question.
Why not?
Because Billy ain't coming back.
Why not?
Long story.
The guy moved in through the hallway and glanced up the stairs. He looked at the ceiling. He looked at the walls. He turned this way and that, craning his neck like a contractor about to ballpark an estimate.
He said, Did you check the refrigerator?
Reacher said, What?
Food?
No.
Noble moved to the kitchen. He looked at the dishes in the sink. He opened the refrigerator. He glanced back as if counting heads. He said, We could share bacon and eggs. There's beer to drink.
Mackenzie said, You're going to eat Billy's food?
First of all, it ain't Billy's anymore, and second of all, I have to. I can't claim expenses if there's food in the house.
Expenses from who?
You, in the end, Noble said. The taxpayer. We're saving you money.
We make you eat dinner from the suspect's refrigerator?
It's your refrigerator and mine. This place became federal property at 2 o'clock this afternoon, seized by the government.
So where's Billy?
That's the long part of the story, Noble said. We should eat.
At his age, after the things he had done, Reacher would have said there wasn't much coming in terms of new and delightful experiences in his life. But strangely, the bacon and egg dinner in Billy's kitchen was one of them. They felt like conspirators, or castaways, like a random group stranded overnight at the airport. They didn't really know each other. Maybe the first-class cabin, taken by taxi to a country hotel. Mackenzie found candles and lit them, which then made it feel like the start of a movie. The opening scenes. An innocent group gathers. Little do they know. Noble cooked and talked about heroin. It was both his paycheck and his passion. He knew its history. Once upon a time, it was a legal ingredient. It was in all kinds of stuff, branded with famous names still known today.